Welcome, everyone, to the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast by Fantastic Geek. My name is Matt, and joining me as always is Pete. Hiya, Pete.
You must be truly desperate to come to me for help, Matt.
It sometimes feels that way, Pete.
Just want to point out that today's podcast about Thor the Dark World is brought to you by the good peoples of Shreddy's Cereal.
And indeed, Pete, if you would like to help the podcast while eating your Shreddies or perhaps having a digestive cracker, you can head over to shieldpodcast.blogspot.com. There's a PayPal link if you want to help us with those storage and bandwidth costs.
Very good. Well, in today's debriefing of Thor the Dark World, let's dive right in, Matt. Second character of the Avengers to get a sequel of his own in Thor. Iron Man had two subsequent sequels himself, and I think we really got to flesh out the more fantastical universe of Asgard and adding other realms to that. What's your overall impression?
All the realms. I thought that it was, first of all, it was a marvelous movie.
It's a Marvel movie, Matt.
Indeed.
Really, that's like redundant, but anyway.
But I thought it was also marvelous. The fact that they have gone so far from kind of the small and limited world, if you will, of the first Iron Man movie, where it's like so similar to what we kind of know, except this guy, you know, instead of going into like Microsoft, you know, software type stuff, he goes into like military hardware, and you know, we just kind of slightly step out of our own world a bit. Here we are literally outside our world, and it was just the whole kind of, you know, where magic and science meet in full force, and just an absolutely fantastic movie. I had no huge problems with the original, but this I think was superior to the original. It solved some of the little problems that the first one had, and just a fantastic outing.
I would agree. I'm interested to hear what problems you think the original had.
Well, I don't like that I just use the word problems, but here's how I would have liked to improve the first one. Not that I would necessarily know how. I would say more with Frigga, played by Rene Russo, more with Darcy, more in Asgard. I say that would be three areas that I would have liked to have seen more of. I know that, you know, at a certain point you need to have Thor on Earth, and you know, we need to be working S.H.I.E.L.D. in, and so on and so forth. This movie, though, we do spend more time in Asgard. We do have more Darcy, and we do have just a beautiful story arc there with Rene Russo's character of Mom, aka Frigga, and just, you know, all three elements that I think were a bit underused in the first movie. For plot purposes, don't get me wrong, I understand what that first movie needed to accomplish, but this movie had those three in spades, along with lots of other goodies.
I'll jump right into the lone problem I had with the movie, and it really kind of took me out of it for a good 2-3 minutes. So we catch up with Thor for the first time, and he's you know, restoring order to the other realms after the events of the Avengers and the chaos that had broken out across the nine realms. And, you know, he clobbers a gigantic rock man with Mew Mew. And so the Warriors Three show up, and I am instantly going, that's not the same guy, and that's not the same guy. And that's a hang up I have. It's called continuity. And I get schedules and all that. And I also get that these are more minor characters. And I say that in all due respect to their following throughout fandom. You know, we need Lady Sif, and thank goodness we got the lovely Jamie Alexander back as Sif. And we'll talk more about her in a moment. You know, and we have Volstagg, who along with Sif winds up in the secret scene, which we'll talk about later in the podcast. But instantly I'm going, okay, Hogan or whatever the guy's name is.
Hogan.
Okay. The Asian, Warrior Three, and Fandral, the one everyone knows as the guy with the sword and the goatee, immediately looked different to me. Now, I've since researched that the actor playing Hogan is the same, but I don't know whether he had some work done. I know he had the beard and everything. Did not look the same at all. And then it definitely was a different guy playing Fandral, because I guess the actor who plays him is on Once Upon a Time. But that really, you know, that caught me. Just because they were more involved in the original. And, you know, it's just a thing, man.
Yeah, I totally agree with you that I was surprised that they kept, of the three, they kept returning to Zachary Levi's Fandral the most. I would have personally liked to have seen more of Ray Stevenson's Volstagg in that role. I mean, obviously, obviously for the girl stuff, I'm glad they let Sif do it, you know, just because she's the girl. But I understand, hey, good job, Joshua Dallas. You have an ongoing role in Once Upon a Time. Acting is about work. Got to keep working. No problem there. You need to recast. But yeah, it just was constantly like, that's that one guy who's different. And I know that obviously they've done this before with Rhodey. But I agree. I was just sitting there the entire time going, I really like Ray Stevenson. Can't you make him be like the most important of the three?
And alas. I think it's a backhanded compliment. I want to turn, you know, my gripe into a backhanded compliment that, you know, how many movies are we deep now? Three Iron Men, two Thors, an Avengers, that's six, a Hulk, seven, and I feel like I'm leaving one out.
I feel like you're two. I think it was eight total, right?
Captain America.
Okay. There you go.
So we're eight films deep, and that they have been this consistent within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think, you know, really they have nowhere to go but down. You know, we've talked before on this podcast that eventually it's going to come to a point where either, you know, one of these Avengers gets recast, or, you know, something is bound to break. Matt, I know you've referred on the Twitterverse as the synergy throughout the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But, you know, I just want to couch my criticism and say that, you know, it really speaks again to how well they've done to this point.
Yeah, and I think you raise a good point, because at the end of the day, you know, was the movie any different having needed to recast the one for the other? No, not at all. But the fact that the quality is so high and the continuity is so high, it lets us dedicate 5 minutes to saying Joshua Dallas versus Zachary Levi. What do you think? So, yeah, at the end of the day, as you said, it might be a backhanded compliment, but it's a compliment nonetheless.
You mentioned the lady stuff before, Matt. Let's talk about the lady stuff. We talked about the Warriors 3. I'm going to talk about the Girls 3.
Ooh.
Okay? In Natalie Portman, Jamie Alexander, and Kat Dennings. For my money, maybe the most attractive female cast of any Marvel movie, and maybe of any movie going right now.
I would be hard pressed to disagree. I mean, you throw in a slightly different age set, you know, Renee Russo is looking absolutely fantastic. I have a special place in my heart for her, from Thomas Crown Affair and her somewhat, gauzy dress in that, but absolutely. I mean, and you know what? Three great, strong female characters. Three characters where I think it would be very easy to have any of them be, obviously, least of all with Sif, but you could have any of them be kind of too girly or too damsely in distress, particularly times when, I don't know, our lead damsels in distress, but they're always incredibly, incredibly true to themselves. You know, they're not all warrior ladies, but does anything fluster Darcy? I don't think so. She appears completely unflappable. You know, Jane Foster is completely ready to stand up for herself, to analyze the situation, pros and cons, as the intellectual character that she is. And just, I mean, you know, just a fantastic, fantastic roster of ladies here.
Definitely. And, you know, we talk all the time about the casting that Marvel and Disney have made both here and moving forward. I mean, Glenn friggin' Close is in Guardians of the Galaxy. Okay. Natalie Portman has been in two Thor movies, which, again, not to denigrate our subject matter, but this woman won Best Actress 2 years ago. Okay.
Yeah.
And she's made more Thor movies than she has, quote unquote, serious movies. And granted, that's the nature of the contract she probably signed.
Right.
Okay. But, you know, yeah, I mean, they just continue to push the right buttons. I did get a feeling, I was a little worried that Sif was going to wind up being the Loki to the Dark Elves, like she was one of them.
Well, that's an interesting theory. I hadn't hadn't considered that while I was watching.
They threw a couple reaction shots a couple times that made it seem like, all right, she wants Jane Foster out of the way so she can have Thor, and maybe that's going to be the play there.
And you know what? I'd rather have less Sif time and a slightly less complex Sif character than use her as, I'm the jealous would-be girlfriend / future queen. I like to have servants comb my hair, and that would happen if I was queen. Therefore, I'm going to throw the other girl to the wolves. Like, I'd rather just dispense with all of that. And Sif is a big girl, and she knows sometimes you get the guy, sometimes you don't. You know, you dry your tears, you eat your bowl of Asgardian ice cream, and you move on. More fish in the sea. That's what grown-up kids do.
This is true. Really dug the Captain America cameo. I thought was very well worked in. They brought Alan Silvestri in just to do the march for Captain America when he shows up there in that, you know, long
did
shot
they really?
Of Loki turning into different people. What's that?
I mean, I know it was the Alan Silvestri music. Did they actually bring him in for that, or was that just
there was a credit towards the end, because, you know, we sit and watch everything here and dissect the Marvel films.
By the way, the audience I saw it with, probably, I would say probably 90% of the audience stayed through the first secret scene, which we'll hit in level 7, and probably 60% stayed through to the very, very end. Which
it's
and
out
I
there,
turned,
man.
Yeah, I turned to my brother and I was like, finally, there are people who get it.
Definitely.
Pete, I do have a question for you. You know, we heard a week or two ago on the podcast from our intern, Ian, who mentioned that there was one moment. Let's see. I hope I'm not misreading this here. Certainly, he referenced how the whole audience laughed out loud. I think that was Captain America. Then he said one in particular that was totally unexpected. Was that on the cameo end, or is he maybe referring to the end, which we'll get to in due course? But what are your thoughts on that? The unexpected twist that our intern Ian refers to.
I wasn't completely clear, and some of the words that Ian had written to us definitely resonated. Reading it back to me again here, I'm not quite clear what he may have been referring to. And granted, he needed to parse that a little bit so we weren't being too spoiler everyone with spoiler Pete.
Well, here's a couple
again,
highlights.
I saw this as the final cut was locked down and being prepared to ship all over the world.
I mean, you were even making comments from the workshop print before all the effects were done.
Yes.
Here are a few highlights from Ian's email. Quite a few moments that made the whole audience laugh out loud, and one in particular that was totally unexpected, by me at least. He references the couple of the cameos, one that sort of defines a Marvel movie and one that was totally unexpected. He mentions some of the Star Wars sound effects, which I in particular would like to talk about. And then he concludes, of course, by saying, that's all for now, and don't call me an intern, which didn't make sense until I was in the theater. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, my goodness, now I get it.
Yes.
So, Pete, how about this? We'll kind of work backwards here. Were those kind of Star Wars sound effects, or did somebody at Disney conglomerate say, you need spaceship effects, go see Bob at Skywalker Sound, he works for us now, have him do those sound effects, we're not paying any extra for it because he's already salaried, go.
Well, they were credited. I don't have a problem with it. I mean, spaceship sounds, you know, if I was hearing lightsaber sounds with the little glowing swords, I think we're having a beef. But, you know, all right, it kind of sounds like a TIE fighter. I heard the same things about, you know, the Klingon ships in Star Trek Into Darkness, okay? Things traveling fast make a whiny noise, as far as I understand physics, and engines, and maybe some stylistic aerodynamics. It didn't really bother me.
I was a little surprised when Algrim, who of course is played by Adewale Akinjobi, AAA.
Mr. Echo.
Indeed. I was a little confused when he was in full kind of evil guy mode and he was standing there going... I thought maybe that was a bit much, but you know, I'm sure it was in the course of the character, all, you know, mutated and whatnot. But so, Pete, I mean, as to these, as to Ian's email here concerning the two cameos, I maybe we need to hear back from our favorite intern, Ian. The one that sort of defines a Marvel movie, I think certainly that was Captain America. The other one, I'm off the top of my head, I'm not thinking what that could be.
Well, again, you know, if our intern, oops, sorry, Ian, if Ian would like to clarify, he knows how to get in touch with us.
Although maybe it's the secret scene one that we'll get to. That might be to what he is referring.
It's possible.
So what else is going on here in the debrief, Pete? What did you like? I think there was hardly anything to dislike.
Yeah, I mean, overall, it advances the legacy of the previous film. I think, as we both agree, it is a better film than the first film. And that's saying a lot, because I think the first is one of the better efforts of phase one of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But I give it a respectable 3 out of 4. I don't think we've found the ceiling yet with Marvel movies, and that, I think, is a great thing. I mean, I would say Avengers is the best of all the films put forth thus far, only because it's got so much going into it. You know, we've both circled Guardians of the Galaxy next year. I'm on the record as saying that's going to be the highest grossing film of 2014. And, you know, just keep them coming. You know, when we talk a little bit later in the podcast about the forward momentum here, you know, I think that's when things are really going to start to get more unpredictable in terms of what they're going to offer us. But at least we have a little bit of a hint.
Absolutely. Two other quick things from me, two Brits here. Great to see more of Idris Elba as Heimdall. I think that he was a tad underused in the first movie. Again, yeah. Maybe just the nature of it. The fact that they gave him a little bit more to do, to the point that I know in the first movie, and I don't know the Thor comic mythology. We'll make that very clear to all our listeners. Neither you nor I are Thor fans in the comic books, but I wasn't entirely clear after the first movie, you know, is he as guardian the way everybody else is? Does he have a little extra magic in his boots? Does he always stand there 24/7 while other people have beds? In this, we kind of see, you know, oh, it's Bifrost shutting down time. I'm going to go to the tavern where Thor is. I'm going to take my helmet off. Were they going out of their way to include more Idris Elba? I mean, if they were, then it was totally effective. It didn't seem shoehorned in. Fantastic to see him. And then great casting there as Christopher Eccleston as Malekith. Now, Pete, a lot of our listeners would recognize Christopher Eccleston. You probably wouldn't. You see, Pete, he was in a television program in the United Kingdom called Doctor Who. About 8 years ago, and he played the Doctor, or as you might call him, the Doctor Who. And while not tippity top on the list, certainly was credited in bringing that, kind of being the Doctor that helped bring the show back and whatnot. So it was certainly great seeing Christopher Eccleston there. Although, Pete, I was a little bit aware that his northern accent came through a little bit in this, but I just said to myself, well, he just must be from the northern part of his world.
Yeah, you know what? I recognized him as the guy with the silver skin from the G.I. Joe movie, and just moved on after that.
Speaking of moving on, Pete, what's next?
Well, let's talk dossier here. We're going to delve into our number of bad guys between the dark elves who serve Malekith in their quest of the Aether, and a rather, what I found, low-key Loki in Thor the Dark World.
Ooh. Well, certainly he's low-key while he's still in prison, although I think that it's a nice bit of acting slash set decoration slash, you know, makeup and that sort of thing when Thor first goes to see him in prison. Loki's illusion is pulled aside, and he just clearly, without them going out of their way, without them showing it on screen, clearly he's let out his frustration, his grief at the loss of his, I'll call her his mother. I'll let him refer to it as his adopted mother or whatever it might be, but how he's clearly had this rage. He's knocked the room apart. Just this wonderful little touch. He's barefoot. There's blood on the bottom of his foot where clearly he's cut it as he's kicked things around and whatnot. So I didn't particularly mind kind of the lower energy start of the movie for Loki, just because here he is, he's paying the piper for what he did in the previous two movies in which he's appeared.
Well, we'll talk a little bit about the scene in the cell in a bit, but I pick up, you know, with the beginning, and, you know, so we've had a movie between this one and the Avengers in Iron Man 3, which, based on what's happening here, is happening concurrently. You know, Loki gets brought back to Asgard to answer for his crimes. And I just dig that we're on such a canvas at this point that things can be happening simultaneously in different places, and we're going to flesh them out over several different chapters. You know, we get the Captain America preview on this print, and you know, we know of things ramping up on our world, but to see that Loki is you know, he's paying the price. Last time we saw him, he even had a mouthpiece on, you know, assuming they were worried about him trying to use magic or, you know, use his mouth, which often is his biggest weapon, to sow discord amongst his captors. And given the way that this film ends, who's to say that he didn't at some point throughout it? So, you know, with Loki a little bit later on in the cell, Matt, maybe you missed it real quick, you know, when he found out about Frigga from the guard, you know, and they just showed a quick shot of it. He did start to rip the room apart.
And then really? I must have somehow missed that.
Yeah, he moved the furniture, you know, with whatever telekinesis. And then the next time, to see him completely disheveled with the really bad wig, that the Loki fangirls must have been like, wait, no. you know, the dried blood, which, you know, I don't know if the tones were off or anything, kind of looked like poo smeared a little bit on the side.
Hold on. Do you know what ice giant blood looks like?
Matt, you're talking to Spoiler Pete here.
Well, I'm just saying, look, you're Spoiler Pete in this realm.
I got a little jar of it right here. Okay. I know what ice giant blood looks like. It wasn't ice giant blood. Okay. Anyway.
By the way, two quick things that you've lit up in my brain. First of all, I wish that when we first see Loki, he had that mouthpiece and it was removed, just because it was so kind of, maybe iconic is a bit much, but it certainly was so kind of like eye-catching at the end of Avengers. I would have liked to just have seen that through line. Here he still is in chains, even if they were just taking it off just to say, hey, the last time you saw him, this is like 5 minutes later.
Well, you got to let him talk here. There's no sense having him. And, you know, he's not the protagonist in the film, but, you know, he's not the antagonist either. And but he's got to talk, and it sets up the events at the end of the film. And, you know, I really wondered when we thought he was dead, whether that was it, and whatever tricks he had in being able to do that. And, you know, finally showing us to, you know, his different ways in and out of Asgard that were hinted at very strongly in the original. You know, they want to get as much mileage out of him as they can. He's enormously popular. He might be the second most popular character in the Marvel Cinematic Universe right now after Tony Stark, Iron Man.
I think that's a completely fair thing to say, particularly in, I mean, just the fan buzz, let alone the fangirl buzz that I know Marvel would love to have, guys and girls alike going. I mean, there's 50-50 distribution on the planet. I think they'd love to see more girls coming to these movies. By the way, Pete, just out of curiosity, you said that you had a Captain America trailer in front of your movie. Yes. Did not.
Oh, okay.
Did you by any chance see it in 3D?
No.
Okay, I don't know, maybe it's just unique to my theater. I know I was in the room, I was in the theater the entire time for the previews, but anyhow, just a little anecdote there.
Let's talk about the Dark Elves and Malekith in their quest here for the Aether. For me, they were really reminiscent of the Prometheus aliens along with the Shy Guys from Super Mario Brothers 2. What say you, Matt?
Well, I don't know how much I could say after that humorous take on it. I thought that, look, were they the strongest, most involved bad guys that we've had in a Marvel movie where we understand their perspective and where they're coming from? Not really, but you know what? At the end of the day, this isn't a movie that needs to be terribly grounded in our world. Like, for example, it's not literally grounded very much in our world. So the fact that they have bad guys who are just like, on this quest 5,000 years ago, they had the quest to do the thing when all the stuff got in line, and now they're back in time to do the thing again and to destroy everything. Like, okay, that's good enough for me. I don't need some sort of, but it is revenge for what you have done for me, or I think I'm being a good guy for my people. And it's just like, no, they're just kind of evil, as in tales of myth and legend, of which this world takes place in the world of myth and legend. So I was completely fine with that, and I thought that certainly visually they were tremendously interesting to look at. Eccleston's makeup, which changed, I think, three times. It kind of had phase one, then phase two was with the burn, and phase three where it was like burn plus kind of an obsidian tone to him. So just, good old-fashioned baddies the entire movie.
Oh, I didn't say I didn't like them. I just, what it reminded me of, man. what I like too, you mentioned, we have the exposition at the beginning and, Odin tells us a story much like in the initial Thor film. And then the Shrek-esque moving storybook later on exposition with Jane Foster, I found pretty cool to get that in there.
Wondered if, how the realms, when they come together, they kind of overlap. I had wondered if maybe, 1,000 years ago or something, the realm of Asgardian picture books kind of merged with kind of Harry Potter newspapers to be one and the same.
Yeah, anyway. so we have this dark elf on a shelf in Malekith who, sacrificed his own people and has had one ship waiting out there for the Aether to wake up. And wouldn't you know, and I think from a story perspective, the one thing that, all right, they talked about the convergence, but that of all people, Jane Foster essentially just happens to bump into the Aether, wherever it was stored, I think was a little over convenient.
Convenient, yes. I mean, certainly I think... Is the movie aware that it's convenient? Well, they're aware enough for Thor to say, fate has brought us together again. All right, if you're going to show the hand of the writer and then have the show go, boy, it's like something is writing all this down, making it happen. If you're going to do that, to me, that's no harm, no... If you're going to do that once in the movie, that's no harm, no foul, as long as you acknowledge it, which they did.
And the other thing with the cursed, I would have liked maybe just a little bit more, not exposition, but all right, so they have these guys that they weaponize into super soldiers. I think it was a little convoluted in what was going on there. Didn't realize that it was Mr. Echo until the credits, and I knew he was going to be in it going in. But the bull meets Darth Vader meets suicide bomber meets, you know, super soldier. Again, I just found it had too much going on.
Oh, so maybe they're like suicide bomber fundamentalists. That's what you're, that's our hook into the real world.
I mean,
like they're Al Qaeda. They've been waiting all this time and they're ready to. No.
I mean, that may have been what they were going for. I just think they were trying to do too much with, you know, a secondary character.
See, was he a secondary character? Yes. I mean, I just kind of felt like he was the muscle that was going to carry you through a couple of battle scenes until you could finally have the showdown between Malekith and Thor that, of course, was going to conclude the movie. I just kind of thought that he was the, I don't know, the embodiment of like, oh, that's, you know, it's not, you know, all the baddies running through, you know, the swarm of 100. It's like swarm of 100. Oh, plus him. He's the embodiment of, you know, the first phase of the people who've landed and attacked.
You know, he plays that secondary henchman, you know, lieutenant role. But I don't know. I just think there was this attempt at a side story going on there. You know, he's told you'll be the last of the curse. You're going to make the sacrifice, et cetera, et cetera. And I don't know. I think it maybe strove for more than it achieved. I don't have a problem with that, but it just, again, it was something that caught me up a couple times. Like, all right, so he's doing this. You know, I would have been better if it was just him on the sacrificial and, you know, the sleeper getting into their cell and blowing it up. But then he's still running around after that. And he's in the scene in the dark world with Loki and Jane and Thor. And I don't know.
Fair enough. Well, that, Pete, I think we've hit everything there on the dossier. What's next?
Well, in our level 7 segment here, we're going to talk theories, both in terms of the Marvel Cinematic Universe and then what this means for us with a weekly Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. podcast. First question I have for you, Matt, is what happened to Hannibal?
Yeah, where is the Odin father? I think that...
You mean the All-Father?
Well, that too. They call him the Odin father at certain points, maybe in the first movie. I know they say Odin father at some point.
Yeah.
I think that here's what I think the movie wants us to propose at this point, although it's not necessarily the gospel truth. When we see, you know, happy as guardian warrior back on Dark World, kind of getting ready to beam back out, I think we're supposed to be like, wait, what? What is that exactly? I think we are meant to assume that Loki obviously faked his death because, hello, he's alive at the end, but that he found warrior guy, quick killed him, took his visage, and then popped back to Asgard. And then, I mean, I think what has happened to Odin, I perish the thought to think that they would have killed him off camera in a way where you're not going to see Anthony Hopkins playing Odin in the next movie. Could you have Anthony Hopkins still back to collect his lovely paycheck playing the Loki image of Odin? Sure, but I feel like there's something slightly inauthentic that me as an audience member wouldn't like that. I'd still rather cut to real Odin in the secret, you know, the secret prison chamber, and he gets rescued in the end to blah, 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 or something like that. But clearly Loki is back. I think it's, we can only assume he came back, you know, under the guise of that that nice warrior man. And I don't know, that's my theory, Pete. You have read the unwritten script for Thor 3, currently entitled Loki's Bugaloo. What are your thoughts?
Well, there will be no surprise that Loki will be the big bad in the third Thor movie. I don't know what Anthony Hopkins' contract looks like. We've seen this before, you know, one character masquerading as another. I just want to know where he is. Has he been killed? I think it would be way too flippant of them to kill an actor of the magnitude of Sir Anthony Hopkins off screen. So whether it's through a flashback or some other device to let us know what's happened to him, it'll be coming. I mean, maybe that comes in a secret scene, Matt, between now and then. Yeah. So, moving on here, speaking of secret scenes, or what we would more rightly call the mid-credit scene here, at the end of the film, we are introduced to Benicio del Toro's The Collector, and he meets with Lady Sif and Volstad, and he takes into his possession one of what we've learned are now the Infinity Stones. And Matt, we've talked about the Infinity Stones, or the Infinity Gems as they are more commonly known, on the podcast before.
We certainly have, and I believe it was in the course of our Thor podcast, or at least one of the podcasts during the summer, where it was brought to our attention, well, brought to my attention, you of course knew about it from back in 2011, that there is a quick scene in the vault in Asgard in the first Thor movie of the Infinity Gauntlet, the Infinity Gems, some sort of thing like that. Now, Pete, I think we should pause here. Let's be sensitive to those who might not be in the know. Can you give a quick little bit of background?
Well, a gauntlet, Matt, is a device that was used in the Middle Ages. It is more akin to a glove that would extend up the forearm for protection.
Well, Pete, specifically in the context of the Infinity Gauntlet, it's
well,
this
infinity,
special glove.
Matt, infinity means without end. Is often represented by the sideways eight, which would also be known as Google.
So, Pete, the Infinity Gauntlet is this glove that has six stones or gems on it that lets you do a whole bunch of stuff. That's the extent to which I know, with one exception. All I know in addition to that is the 7-minute scene from Parks and Recreation where Patton Oswalt improvs this mixing of the Marvel Cinematic Universe with Disney, with X-Men, and
let's not forget that he was explaining the plot of the new Star Wars movies. That's what.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So if you want to know, in all seriousness, if you want to know more about the Infinity Gauntlet, go look up on YouTube Patton Oswalt, Parks and Recreation, watch his whole masterful 7.5-minute improvised thing, and he explains what the different gems do and how they work and how they can bend reality and so on and so forth.
Yes. And so the Aether is revealed to be one of the six gems. They explain in that brief scene that we can't have the Tesseract and this be together on Asgard. It would be too dangerous to have two of the gems together. So clearly these things are spread around, and again, MacGuffins of the coming films. And the Collector takes them into his possession in his little museum there with all sorts of other worldly trinkets and sinister...
Otherworldly trinkets.
What's that?
Otherworldly trinkets.
That's what I said.
I thought you just said worldly trinkets.
Otherworldly trinkets.
Ah, yes. Okay, I take that back.
Yeah,
I withdraw
play on
my
words, man.
Yes, well done, Pete.
Yeah. So anyway, he takes it into possession, and then he reveals to his assistant there... And this was a scene that was put together very late in the production of Guardians of the Galaxy, as the Collector is a major force in that movie, that, you know, one down, five to go. So these will be the items that Thanos, who is teased at the end of the Avengers, will be tracking down as we move through phase two and into phase three.
Yeah, I know that there's probably was Kevin Feige who said this, that the payoff for Thanos is not expected to be anytime soon, a la Guardians of the Galaxy. That's a much longer picture than that. So if this is something where, I mean, obviously, as you said, yes, the Collector is going to be in Guardians of the Galaxy. But if we basically, if the Infinity Stones, the Infinity Gauntlet, all of this, if none of this is of direct importance to Guardians of the Galaxy, I will almost appreciate that more, because then we'll have Thanos and Avengers, then this here, and then maybe a little you know, reference here. Oh, now I, you know, reference to, oh, now I have two, or just something like that in Guardians of the Galaxy to work up to wherever it is that we're headed in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Well, the moment they made Avengers Age of Ultron, who is a much more recent, like within the past 5 years, recent villain in the Marvel comic universe, you know, we knew that Thanos wouldn't be the big bad of that movie. Thanos is in Guardians of the Galaxy. That is not a spoiler by any stretch of the imagination. I have to believe that the full-blown payoff for the Infinity Gauntlet will come in the third Avengers film.
The third or the second?
The third.
Wow.
Yeah, hey, I think they're, I mean, consider it. Let's, you know, one of the gems offhand of the Infinity Gauntlet is the time gem. Okay. Again, essayed so impromptu and perfectly by Patton Oswalt. You know, the next Marvel movie on deck, Captain America. He's now the man out of time. You know, he was the capsicle for 70 plus years, and now he's back in our time, or should I say forward in our time. I think that'll become a means of him maybe getting a little something back through time with Peggy. You never know.
Ooh, that certainly is a nice little theory there. It'll maybe they'll go back in time to before Marvel sold away the rights to X-Men, Spider-Man, and Fantastic Four. Although, in all seriousness, and I know I'm oftentimes the one to bring up that deal and to kind of say, oh, one day, it's not like it didn't work out well for Marvel at the time, you know, to sell those rights, to have a hand in production of movies. I mean, nobody, you know, there was no market for comic book movies before the first X-Men movie. I mean, there was some market, but Marvel's done just fine using the characters that they have. And, you know, it was in the news this week, Pete. I know this isn't exactly level 7, but maybe we'll spend 20 seconds talking about how Marvel and Netflix are going to be teaming up to do 4 at least limited run series on some of the lesser known Marvel characters, the best known of which is Daredevil. So, you know, Marvel's doing okay.
Doing more than okay.
Yeah.
I'm almost worried now, given Matt, that we've jumped in on the tent pole. You know, it's now part of a TV franchise, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. I'm almost worried that they're going to be doing too much. Are we potentially looking at the Star Trekification at its zenith in terms of, you know, having two shows in production right at all times? Could we quickly be heading there with Marvel is more than a slight concern I have upon hearing that news this week. I mean, we reported a couple weeks back that they were kicking around an Agent Carter show. Who knows
yes
what the status of that is?
Well, okay, based on what I've read this week, there still are plans, whether it's Agent Carter or not, there still are plans for a second broadcast, a second ABC Marvel-related show. Now, if your concern is, and I think Star Trek is a wonderful example, doing too much, striking while the iron's hot to the point that you know you get all the blood out of the stone. Here's my thought for that. Disney seems to be the smartest of these conglomerates in the entertainment world, because they're not fighting the future and they're not giving up on the past. They're not CBS that really holds on to their stuff away from online and streaming. They're not like, you know, they're also not like a Netflix where it's all online, right? Disney, I think, is happy to say we are a major force in the broadcast arena. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., despite a slight cooling of the ratings, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is... let me back up. A slight cooling in the total number of viewers, it still is doing fine in its time slot. It's doing fine for the day compared to other shows on Wednesdays, Tuesdays, and it's doing fine for its rating, its 18 to 49 rating. all of these things, they're happy in the broadcast arena. Guess what? No major network, no cable network is going to do a Luke Cage show or a Jennifer Jones show. Perhaps maybe a Daredevil show, but if you're going to make it R-rated, what's it going to be? FX, HBO, Showtime, that's about it. They're using all their parts. Let's push something into the streaming arena and make some money off that. Use our properties off that. Stuff that can be broad enough, let's put it on broadcast. As long as they have enough people thinking through these shows, I think they'll be just fine. I really do. I don't think it's going to be a case of... You know, part of the Star Trek thing, too, was you have one team working on Next Generation and movies and Voyager, and another team working on Deep Space Nine, and let's keep them separate. Go ahead, Pete.
This is definitely true. I just, you know, the amount of material. I mean, listen, it's robust right now. And just looking over the numbers, you know, Thor through today, as we're talking, has earned $327 million worldwide.
That's incredible.
Essentially days of release.
Well, it's been out a little longer internationally. It's maybe been out 10 days internationally.
Still. It's a hefty chunk of change.
Absolutely. Okay?
And, you know, I would think you run the risk so soon. I mean, we're talking 2015 on the Daredevil series to come first through Netflix, of just spreading it, the material thin. By no means do I mean, Disney's got limitless resources to really put behind this. You know, I'm just a little concerned with that they might try to overmine it at this point.
Well, and if this is apples and oranges, feel free to say so. You know, we saw Avengers a year ago, May, right? And then there was an entire year without Marvel movies. Then we had Iron Man 3 this past May, then Thor, you know, November, Captain America in April, and Guardians of the Galaxy the following August.
It's a two picture per year situation through 2015 right now.
Okay.
That being what it is, you know, and we may ultimately look back at this, Matt, and say, well, that was the golden era of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But yeah. eight movies deep to this point, okay, and it's really starting to crank. And given that they just got into TV in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., that's my only concern is, okay, two movies a year, a TV show already going on, and now all these others is my larger concern.
Well, I'll tell you this.
Quality, not quantity.
Yeah. From a viewing point of view, here would be my hope, right, that you do something like, hey, I'm sorry, when's Daredevil supposed to come out? 2015.
Spring of 2015. So leading up to, I would assume, time-wise to Avengers 2.
Okay. But if you had like some sort of crossover moment between Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Daredevil, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. concludes its broadcast year in May because it's in the broadcast space. It has to do a certain number of episodes with a certain number of reruns in order to sell your advertising time. Great. Then have the full knowledge that, hey, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is done with. And the following week, all 13 episodes drop on Netflix. There's your summer viewing. At least TV-wise, Marvel TV-wise, and maybe it's a completely different experience. Maybe it's R-rated, where Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is not. Maybe it's PG-13 with, you know, cable level of swears. Whatever it is, I feel like it could be... Certainly, they wouldn't be in direct competition like they're on at the same time because of the nature of it being on Netflix. But I think that it could be a really interesting experience where they're really not in competition, where these shows are maybe coming out, you know, in the holidays, when Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is on hiatus, or in the summer, something like that, to kind of...
Oh, I don't believe for a moment that Disney will pit itself against itself with that. No. And what you said is entirely too plausible to not be on the table right now. I do really have a hard time believing they'll go, you know, past a PG-13 with these. Their stuff has been so... family friendly. I mean, when I saw this with an audience the other day, you know, we were there with little girls who love Loki. And to think that they would automatically limit you know, and these girls were watching Avengers on Netflix when I picked up my buddy and we went to the movies. So wow. To think that they would in some way limit, oh, all right, here's the part of Netflix with some Marvel guys that you can't watch. They're not stupid. They're not stupid. And granted, while those girls will be, you know, teens by the time this stuff gets rolling out, you know, they're not going to exclude themselves. I think it might be more, you know, risque in terms of the tone. You know, they're going to fully mm-hmm. explore Hell's Kitchen here and Daredevil and Luke Cage and all that. But I definitely don't think it's going to be hardcore R Punisher territory.
So I see. So maybe you have some basic cable, 9 p.m., 10 p.m. language, some of that violence, some of that kissy face under the sheet, but not on top of the sheet, things like that, where I think that probably makes sense. I mean, there's no need to take it to, and I certainly don't mean this as a slam here, but kind of your standard, you know, HBO 9 p.m. of like, hey, there's a lot of nudity. Like, I would agree that that's not, I think, what Disney or Marvel wants to do with these properties.
It's not porn, Matt. It's HBO.
Ah. That is a lovely little comedy clip that you are referring to. Well, Pete, what else is going on in Level 7? I know that, did you make reference about the Frosty Cat?
I did. The Frost Monster we see at the end, once Thor has returned to Earth and reunited with Jane Foster. So this thing is still running amok, chasing birds in Greenwich. Gotta wonder if that will be the subject of our Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Thor the Dark World tie-in scheduled for Tuesday, November 19th.
Well, Pete, here's the article. Here's the argument against it. And you can rebut if you want.
Mm-hmm.
The Frost Kitty must be tremendously expensive to do with computers. I think to have it on screen for more than a couple seconds would probably be just tremendously expensive. How does Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. pay for that? How does ABC pay for that? You know, it seems to me that kind of the different money pots that these sub strata of the conglomerates work out of. You know, it's not one big pot. It's not just Disney's going to say, oh, let's just have Marvel Studios, you know, Marvel Movie Studios pay for it. It's kind of everybody in their own, you know, bank account there. That's my argument against it. Maybe it's some sort of more mundane cleanup or something, which inspires me less. But there's the argument against we're not going to see the Frost Kitty.
Well, let's just call back some of the high-end CGI stuff we've seen through the first half a dozen episodes. We've seen, characters made of flame and shoot flame. You know, we've seen dump trucks flipped over. We've seen a fairly believable, jump out of the airplane sequence that, you know, really didn't gall you as far as realism. I think they're on a much better level, a quicker turnaround. I mean, the thing that hit me watching Thor in theaters is, you know, we're about little under 2.5 years from the original. To get a movie this FX laden less than 3 years now, after that, you know, that was a significant turnaround.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And I mean, certainly, the listeners know, it's a year after year improvement special effects in general go through. Even you think back to 10 years ago this December when there was the Battlestar Galactica reboot, the quality of spaceship effects that were on there on that show on a very stringent TV budget with two or three million viewers in this country and what they were able to get away with compared to literally concurrent in Star Trek then or a couple of years previous where it's completely models. So I'm certainly no Pollyanna in terms of could you do the Frosty Cat? Could you do some of these effects on a TV show yes. I'm just thinking, what are the limitations to time and budget and that sort of thing. But I guess we'll find out. I mean, I truly am. Yeah, I know we kind of had, you know, I don't want to say we joke about Spoiler Pete because it's deadly serious. But I truly know nothing about that episode that'll be in not the next episode, but the one after that.
Well,
know nothing about it.
It's called The Well. You know that our boy Jonathan Frakes from Star Trek The Next Generation directed it.
Indeed.
You know, again, this is a guy that's working significantly in TV directing right now, has done Castle, has done a lot of other shows. And, you know, to be able to tap him on the shoulder and bring him in, and as you posited too, Matt, this might ultimately wind up being an audition for one of these Phase 2 or Phase 3 movies.
That, I tell you, that would just be so awesome to
God
know
knows they
Riker.
Flip the director's chairs around enough with those.
Yeah.
So to think that and somebody who's clearly working with the Whedons on the TV end to, you know, move it to the film end. And granted, it's been a while since he's done a film. But I don't think these are so much auteur maneuvers. I mean, Joss Whedon aside. Then, you know, all right, this is the group effort. This is the Kevin Feige, you know, Marvel
right.
joint. You know, but I'm not worried about the effects thing so much. I mean, we got a date on the new Star Wars movie the other day, December 18th, 2015. You know, my initial concern was that they were trying to rush it with May, and you know, Disney and Star Wars kind of went back and forth, and you know, ultimately they gave them a little bit of a reprieve, like, all right, here's 6 more months. I think they're wise too, that way they won't be bumping up against Avengers and having two competing franchises owned now by the same conglomerate. That really was the only move to make. You know, the only other thing I'm going to posit, and again, I already know what it is, but I'll just throw out there for our listeners' sake, is that maybe it has some latent, you know, connection to the convergence there, the well, the throwing of things, you know, from one universe to another, from one realm to another. Maybe that's what it could be.
I know I was on the record in the summer saying, let's not do a lot of this crossover stuff. Let's let these characters evolve on their own. Given that it essentially is a small insular family that the 6 characters and Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. Comprise. Yes. I mean, I can we know them more? Sure. We all want that Melinda May flashback. But I feel like we know them well enough to say, great, let's watch them grow on these fantastic adventures. And I hope that episode really does tie into Thor as much as possible. And Pete, to return to your other point about the directors, I think that the model that Marvel is following is that of James Bond, where you actually don't need a director who knows how to do a ton of special effects or who knows how to, you know, all right, you go in the helicopter shot here and somebody in the water here. So when the boat jumps, it's no, you have people who do that just for James Bond. We need somebody who can help craft a quality story. Somebody who can walk up to an actor and say, you know, this tennis ball on a stick that's supposed to be the giant monster. Let's talk about when you were a kid and you went camping and find some way to dig out that emotion. And you look at Alan Taylor, the director of Thor the Dark World. Here's his filmography. 3 movies before Thor the Dark World. 1995, Palookaville. 2001, The Emperor's New Clothes. 2003, Kill the Poor. Does not direct another film until Thor the Dark World. In between that, what does he spend his time doing? Directing Deadwood, the pilot for Mad Men, Bored to Death, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Game of Thrones episodes. This is a guy who has spent his time. Are there special effects in some of those? Yeah, you betcha. But it's about get the characters going. You have this wonderful palette to work with, whether it's the Old West or the Game of Thrones land or, you know, 1960 New York.
You're referring to Westeros, Matt?
Westeros, of course. I was just
Game of Thrones land.
where Thronelandia. But it's somebody it's about almost, let's look past the spectacle and find the character. You know, let's find the drama here, regardless of whether it's, you know, this immaculately recreated town of Deadwood or whether it's computer generated dragons. Find the character. That's what he's done. Hopefully that's what Jonathan Frakes will be doing in a Marvel movie in the near future, Pete.
Definitely.
Well, with that, Pete, I think we've just about hit Thor: The Dark World from every imaginable corner here. Before we get to the podcast contacts, Pete, you are like Thor, actually, in that when you are on Twitter, there are people like that young man in the library who say, "Are you kidding me? I can't turn away. It's Pete out there." So how could people say hello to you on Twitter, Pete?
Well, 1,326 people can't be wrong. You can find me on Twitter at Peter, P-I-E-T-E-R, J, Ketelaar, K-E-T-E-L-A-A-R.
You can find me on Twitter, where I'm Looking Back Lost. And as for the podcast, you can say hello to us on Twitter, where we are Fantastic Geek. That's fantastic with a P-H. You can share your feedback on past podcasts, your predictions on upcoming episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. or, I suppose, even Marvel movies, now that we're only 5.5 months away from Captain America, by emailing fantasticgeek@gmail.com. You can call the listener line, 732-707-1815, and leave a message with our special podcast Heimguard, which will jot that down and send us to that over the Bifrost internet. You can leave a comment on the webpage, shieldpodcast.blogspot.com. And I think that covers all those bases, Pete. I think with that, we can look ahead to the next episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and whatever madcap adventure that'll take us on there.
Definitely.
So with that, Pete, I will say adios, or whatever proper Asgardian goodbye. I will say mew mew to everyone. And
mew, mew.
Pete, it is time for your final word.
I think you just decapitated your grandfather.